We tell everybody to cut back on sodium, but not everyone needs to. In fact, some people who reduce their sodium intake too much, their blood pressure actually goes up. We used to call them outliers, but more and more these outliers respond consistently and reproducibly in the opposite direction that we had anticipated. If there's a way for you to find out that doesn't work for you, obviously, I think that's something you'd want to know.
Welcome to the Good Clean Nutrition Podcast. I'm your host, Ginger Holton, an integrative registered dietitian nutritionist. Today, we're exploring the world of nutrigenomics with my colleague, Dr. Ahmed El-Sohami. Dr. El-Sohami did a postdoctoral fellowship in the Department of Nutrition at the Harvard School of Public Health. He's a professor and associate chair of undergraduate education at the University of Toronto and the founder of the company Nutrigenomics with an X. He's a world-renowned expert on the subject, and actually, he's the one that inspired me to become a certified nutritional genomics specialist, which I did last summer. In our first episode of the series, we'll bring you an overview of nutritional genomics, what it is, and how it can benefit your health. Just yesterday, I was working with one of my long-term clients, and she was reflecting back about when we first started, and she had pretty much stopped taking all her supplements because she was on a whole bunch. She didn't know why she was taking them. And over time, evidenced by the genomic report that we did together, some lab work that she got from her doctor, we found together that she's a person that really needs to take vitamin D. And she said now that her supplements are streamlined and targeted, and she knows exactly why she's taking it and the benefit for her and her health, she has not missed a day in a year. And it's just so fun when I first start working with somebody to use the nutrigenomic report and bring their health story to life. It is personalized in a way that I don't have access to any other way. And so I love partnering with my clients to create these personalized recommendations that they're excited about. And the research also strongly supports that when you have a nutrigenomic report and you get expert advice, you're more likely to stick with those positive behavior changes over time. Let's start at the beginning. When I talk about personalized nutrition, I think about individualized recommendations, treating each person uniquely, considering likes and dislikes, and then also diving into their biometrics like labs or nutrigenomics. How do you define personalized nutrition?
It's all about understanding not only what works best for an individual, but just taking into account some of their preferences and some aversions that people have towards certain foods. We can't just tell everybody to eat more broccoli. Some people perceive it as being incredibly bitter and not pleasant to consume. So we do have to take into account those individual preferences as well as their individual metabolic needs.
My clients are so excited about personalization because they don't just want to hear the standard advice. They don't always want to follow the my healthy plate. They say, what do I do? What does this mean for me? And you are really good at helping get people there. So can you define nutrigenomics?
The term nutrigenomics really is kind of an umbrella term that takes into account understanding how our nutrition interacts with our genetic makeup. And really, we can think of two sides of a coin because we know nutrition can affect our genes, right? Nutrients can turn on and turn off various genes. But at the same time, variations in our genes, in our genetic sequence. So each gene comes in different forms. You might have one version of it. I might have another that functions differently. And so that impacts how we respond to the foods that we consume. There is a gene called the lactase gene that normally breaks down lactose. But some people have a version of it that prevents them from making enough of the enzyme that's produced by that gene. And they're just not able to break down lactose. And so what happens is that lactose goes into the large intestine and it's fermented by bacteria, and then it causes diarrhea and gas and other unpleasant symptoms. And that's kind of a classic example because a lot of people recognize if they have this just by trial and error, right? And if you're not sure, chug a glass of milk and wait to see what happens in the next day or two. But really, the research in this whole field is going beyond just lactose intolerance. It's trying to understand is coffee good for me or is it bad for me? Do I need to consume more folate or am I okay? Do I need to limit my sodium intake? We tell everybody to cut back on sodium, but not everyone needs to. In fact, some people who reduce their sodium intake too much, their blood pressure actually goes up. We used to call them outliers, try to figure out how to get rid of them from our statistical analyses. But more and more, these outliers, those individuals that respond consistently and reproducibly in the opposite direction that we had anticipated. And, you know, what if you're an outlier and the advice that you're being given to everybody is actually causing harm for you? And if there's a way for you to find out that doesn't work for you and you should be doing something else, obviously, I think that's something you'd want to know.
100%. And it's so easy. You do a spit test or a cheek swab, it's so non-invasive. And then you just have this great information that is extremely actionable. And what I hear from my clients over and over again is, I'm so motivated to do these things now because I know what's right for me.
It's interesting you talk about motivation because we know that's a very important piece. We and others have conducted these randomized controlled clinical trials where we compare the effects of giving people DNA-based advice versus the standard recommendations. And sure enough, those who get the DNA-based dietary advice actually understand the recommendations more. They want to learn more. They're more motivated to change their eating habits. And we actually show that they do, in fact, change their eating habits up to a period of at least 1 year, which is how long we followed them up. So that's a really important piece because people recognize that this is not just advice that everyone's getting. This is advice that's tailored to me based on my unique biological needs that are governed by my genetics.
I remember when I first met you and we were talking about your company and it's been around for a long time. And you said, and I have lots of clinical trials on my data. And I was like, okay, sold. It's well established, it's well researched, and it's proven.
Yeah, there are a growing number of companies out there. Many of them are doing a great job at interpreting the science, but some are a little bit iffy. And that's unfortunate because there really aren't that many regulations that govern the interpretation of these kinds of genetic reports. So to some extent, it's buyer beware. And this is largely why we chose to offer the test only through qualified healthcare professionals, not direct to consumer, because then it just comes down to how fancy your marketing is to get people to buy a product. But it's important to recognize that some genetic reports lack very important information that could give you the wrong kind of advice. And others base their recommendations on theoretical pathways, not ones that have actually been demonstrated empirically. It's something that we're hoping to try to clean up and try to establish more harmonized standards so that we can ensure that regardless of which test you get, you're getting the right kind of information that really will help you as an individual.
For the vast majority of people, it can be really helpful. You know, you want to make some changes in your life or you're looking ahead at how do I age gracefully? Or how do I avoid the high cholesterol that my parents have? I'd say the majority of folks could really benefit from this. Who do you see it for the most?
If you eat and drink and you care about your health, you're a good candidate. Now, I recognize that there are individuals that have certain circumstances or conditions where, you know, there's just low-hanging fruit, just some simple things that they just need to do first before they can start to even hyper-personalize their advice. If their diet is just jam-packed with ultra-processed foods that don't have much nutritional value, they're not getting enough of the essential vitamins and minerals from foods, not meeting their fiber intake, or not getting adequate amounts of protein in their diet. Those are simple things that working with a dietitian, it can help them meet those needs. But then for a large segment of the population who are already trying to eat fairly well, that's where there's a great opportunity to say, okay, now for you, let's take a look at your coffee consumption. A lot of people enjoy having the morning cup of coffee, but roughly half the population have a particular version of a gene that makes them slow metabolizers of caffeine, right? They're not able to get rid of it. And for them, if they consume more than just two small cups of coffee, that's going to increase their risk of heart attack, hypertension, prediabetes, and kidney disease. And this has been demonstrated by several very well-conducted trials. So that's one area that a lot of people can relate to it because few people are indifferent to caffeine and coffee. They either love it or they avoid it. And so for someone like me, when I discovered that I was a slow metabolizer, I gradually shifted to drinking decaf. I still enjoy my morning cup of coffee, but I just realized that caffeine is just not good for me because my body does not get rid of it efficiently.
What about metabolic genes? Because I get those questions a lot, and a lot of people come to me and they want to work on their weight in either direction.
Weight management is obviously very important, and we generally look at it from a basic energy in versus energy out. But when we consider both sides of that equation, right? So the energy in, we're talking about proteins, fats, carbohydrates, largely alcohol as well as contributing to our caloric intake. And then the output, largely exercise. Well, not everyone who exercises to the same extent is able to lose weight. And so there is a gene for that. We know exercise is amazing for all kinds of things like heart health and cognitive health. But when it comes to losing weight, for some people, exercise just doesn't do it for them. And again, there's a gene for that. And so it's important to manage people's expectations by saying, okay, we still want to encourage you to engage in regular physical activity, but just so you know, that side of the energy balance equation is not what's going to help you. So we need to focus on the energy input side. And so there we have, again, protein, carbs, and fat largely. A lot of popular weight-reducing diets are high in protein, and it's recommended that people up their intake of protein because it improves satiety, decreases overall energy intake, makes you feel full longer. And even though that's true, by and large, there is a gene for that. And this actually only benefits a segment of the population who have a particular version of the FTO gene. And randomized controlled clinical trials have shown very convincingly that for those who don't have that version of the gene, there's no benefit of increasing protein intake for weight loss. But for those who do have that, there's a huge benefit. And that's why in studies that don't take the genetics into account, you still see a benefit overall of protein because that big effect that happens in a subset of the population predominates and we see an overall benefit. That's just one really clear example. For someone who is thinking of upping their intake of protein for weight loss, they can do it by trial and error, or they can see if they have this version of the FTO gene and just remove some of that guesswork and figure out, okay, this is likely to work for me. Or if it's not, let's look at some other aspects of my energy intake. And there are other genes that can also predict response to carbohydrates and fat.
You bring up a good point. The way that nutrigenomics works is a little bit more broad, like focus more on carbohydrates, fats, or protein, the broad macronutrients, instead of these very specific, oh, you should eat an apple instead of a banana. You do see that on some reports, but my understanding is that is not how the science works.
There really is no test that can or should be telling you eat an apple, not a banana, or eat an orange and not a grapefruit. The science is just not there. What the science can tell us so far is specific micronutrients. And so if we drill down on the different nutrients like vitamin A, C, D, E, some of the minerals like calcium, iron, that's where the research shows that some people have certain versions of genes that make them require a little bit more or perhaps a little bit less of a particular micronutrient. Now, I realize we don't eat nutrients in isolation. We eat foods. And this is why it helps to have this kind of test provided through a registered dietitian so that they can tell you, okay, based on your report, you need more vitamin C, folate, choline and iron, and you need to limit your intake of saturated fat. You don't have to worry as much about sodium. You're lucky. You're part of that 30% that doesn't have to worry about it so much. Let's focus on those genetic and metabolic vulnerabilities to make sure that we can enhance your overall nutritional status. And here are the foods that can tick off a lot of those boxes for those individual micronutrient deficiencies that you might have a higher risk of based on your genetics.
The prioritization is so helpful so that you're like, okay, this is where I spend my time and this is where I don't have to worry as much. But to your point, when you just get a direct-to-consumer test, let's say I do one that is in the mail and it comes to me and it says things like eat more folate and more choline, a lot of people don't know what that is. So then you're like looking it up and you're getting confused. So having that interpretation, especially from a registered dietitian, is so helpful because then I can say, these are foods that have folate and I know you like these types of foods specifically. Let's talk about how to increase it in breakfast. So just the level of personalization it can bring is really powerful.
Absolutely. And as part of the service with Nutrigenomics is we also have a food frequency questionnaire. So a validated dietary assessment tool. This gives both the consumer and their practitioner insight into where they're currently getting their folate and their choline. And so when they recognize that, they're like, oh, okay, I have an egg once a week, but I see that it's a great source of choline. Maybe I can increase the frequency of that. Or I have a salad every afternoon and this is contributing to my folate intake. Maybe I can increase my portion size or choose more of the foods that are contributing to that.
I wanted to go through some other categories of genetics. You talked about caffeine. What about heart health? You mentioned saturated fat. What else falls into the heart health category regarding these genetics?
There's evidence that increasing an individual's fiber intake, or at least whole grain consumption, basically foods that have a low glycemic load. So they're not this rapidly digested carbohydrates like white bread. And the link between foods that are high in the glycemic index and glycemic load have been shown to increase the risk of type 2 diabetes, which is part of cardiometabolic disease and a huge risk factor for cardiovascular disease. There is a gene that predicts response to lowering your consumption of these rapidly digested carbohydrates. And that is to lower your risk of type 2 diabetes, which ultimately lowers your risk of cardiovascular disease.
The diabetes part and talking about the risk there is really helpful. I have a lot of people coming to me that have family history. I also have people coming to me that don't know their family history. Those are some of my favorite people to work with because then we can really look into it. Tell me more about the diabetes aspect of testing.
If I can elaborate on the family history piece, because I think that is very important. And as you mentioned, for those who do have a family history of, let's say, hypertension, that in itself does generally motivate them to seek out solutions so that they don't succumb to that as well. But if you have a patient whose father developed hypertension when they were 55 and their mother got hypertension maybe when she was 49, that motivated that person to come and see you. But what do we do with that information? Do we tell them to cut back on sodium? For some, blood pressure is actually going to go up if we don't know their genetics. Do we tell them to avoid coffee and caffeine? Again, for some, that's actually going to cause harm because they're actually benefiting from that. So while family history, I think, is important to get people through the door, we still need to look at their specific genetics because what they inherit specifically from each of their parents can be different from either parent. And at the end of the day, you still need to know, how do you manage that particular condition, the risk of hypertension? The same applies to diabetes. Families share not only genetics, they also share environments, right? So what was it that contributed to that early onset of diabetes in the family? Was it their diet? Was it their genetics or a combination?
I'm excited to share an innovative new product. Orgain's highly anticipated lactose-free protein powder, Better Whey, is now available. Unlike animal-based whey from milk, Orgain's Better Whey protein powder is created through a gentle fermentation process inspired by traditional methods, yielding a high-quality protein source. This results in a lactose-free, hormone-free, and easier-to-digest product. It's made with 10 times less water, 10 times fewer greenhouse gas emissions, and requires 1.5 times less energy consumption when compared to traditional whey. It tastes really great too. Each serving contains 21 grams of high-quality whey protein isolate, 5 grams of branched-chain amino acids, and 1.5 times the leucine of traditional whey. To learn more, visit orgain.com. One of my favorite things about the report is talking to my clients about the athletic genes. I find that they're really inspirational, and I have all these wonderful conversations about what did you enjoy previously in life? Who were you as a student athlete? What did you do when you were in college? And that helps shape the kind of goals we're going to set now, because a lot of people stop doing fitness as much. And it's a huge part of the goals that I set with them as a registered dietitian.
I call it the fun part of the report, because we're not trying to predict the next Usain Bolt or any other elite athlete. It's really saying, here is where genetically you're kind of lucky, either in power sports or in endurance sports. And beyond that, for athletes, the rest of the report is very valuable, because for an athlete who is looking to optimize their performance, they need to know which micronutrients do they need more of. So when we talk about vitamin C, a lot of athletes don't really think about it very much, but it's essential for collagen synthesis. When your tissues are trying to recover after a training session, some people need a little bit more vitamin C to get that collagen synthesized, which can play a bigger role than collagen supplements that are consumed, because they just get broken down into amino acids. With something like the power gene, where you can have either the typical version or you can have enhanced, which means you're more likely to excel in power, or ultra. Almost all elite sprinters have that ultra version. I say almost because, you know, there's always exceptions to the rule, but it helps you understand where you're likely to excel. Now, it doesn't mean that if you have that ultra for power and don't for endurance, that you shouldn't engage in kind of endurance exercises. Some might argue to the contrary. You should focus more on those, because that's where perhaps you're a little bit weaker. So you want to strengthen that. That section really isn't meant to guide recommendations. It's just meant to inform and give you some insights into just your own strengths and limitations that, you know, we all have in terms of our performance and athletic abilities. Some of the markers actually relate to risk of injury. And one of them that I can relate to personally is the Achilles gene, which increases your risk of Achilles tendon injury. And sure enough, 16 or 17 years ago, I was playing squash and I lunged forward and then I just heard a snap.
Oh.
And it wasn't until several years later when I'd done the test that I discovered I have that genetic propensity for that. Now, had I known back then, would I have warmed up differently? I probably would not have lunged from that extended position where your Achilles is totally stretched and it's most vulnerable to injury. So knowing that can help athletes and just regular individuals figure out how they can warm up and the things that they can do to avoid experiencing some of these injuries.
One aspect of nutrition that I'm less familiar with, and I know you're doing a lot of really interesting research on, is premenstrual symptoms, PMS.
This is an area that we began doing research on over a decade ago because we felt it was a somewhat neglected field of research. Premenstrual symptoms can be quite severe for some women. Approximately 8 to 10% experience very severe symptoms to the point where they have this condition called PMDD, or premenstrual dysphoric disorder. And that has a huge impact on their quality of life. Some women experience extreme cramps, severe fatigue, depressed mood, anxiety during certain periods of their cycle. And so we wanted to know if we can identify certain nutrients or genes that can predict some of those symptoms. And one area that we lucked out on is the research that we did looking at vitamin D and premenstrual symptoms. We actually looked at blood levels of vitamin D. So not just trying to measure when people are consuming, because you can get vitamin D from the sunlight. It turns out that women who have higher blood levels of vitamin D have a lower likelihood of experiencing some of the premenstrual symptoms, but not others. And we look at 15 symptoms, by the way. We drill down to look more specifically to see, does that apply to all women? And then whether or not genetics is important. So we focused in on the main target of the main gene that vitamin D acts on, which is the vitamin D receptor. And that exists in two different forms. And it turns out that women who have a particular version of this gene, that if they have low blood levels of 25-hydroxyvitamin D, the main form of vitamin D, they have more than a 2.5-fold greater chance of experiencing extreme fatigue during that time of their cycle. But for women who have only one copy of that gene, there was absolutely no difference. But what was even more striking is women who had no copies of that gene, they had both copies of the other form, it was the complete opposite, meaning higher levels of vitamin D were associating with higher risk of fatigue. And that we found was quite puzzling, because when you think of vitamin D and fatigue, you think of vitamin D deficiency, right? We often tell, you know, women, well, just take more vitamin D. But approximately 15 to 20% of the population, if they are taking those vitamin D supplements that we're recommending for them to take, that might actually be making things worse. And this is why this field is so important, because some argue you don't need to do a genetic test. Just tell everyone to take a multivitamin. We know that just doesn't work because the research shows it doesn't work. We're showing specific examples that in one group, it might be protective, but in the other group, it has the complete opposite effect. And so when you're not taking genetics into account, it just cancels each other out. But what happens to individuals in those two different groups? The advice that we give them is very different.
That is so interesting. Is that paper published yet?
Yes, we published that just a couple of years ago in the journal Genes and Nutrition. And I've started incorporating it more often in some of the presentations that I've been giving, because it really highlights that stark contrast between having a benefit or having an adverse effect, just the same recommendation.
There is a lot of emphasis right now on gut health and how it affects the entire body. So I'd love your take on this from your work in nutrigenomics specifically.
Yeah, we are collaborating with some of our colleagues in immunology looking at the gut microbiome. And we're learning more and more every day on just how these bacteria metabolize the nutrients that we consume and how that impacts health. But what's very interesting is it turns out that our genetics, so the genetics of the host, we are considered the host to the bacteria, that influences the type of bacteria that colonize our gut. And so this is very important, because it could explain why a lot of studies on probiotics have not been that successful. Because once a person stops taking the probiotic, the bacteria tend to revert back to a particular composition that's largely influenced by that person's genetics. Another thing we are also realizing is that the bacteria can change not only from day to day, but even within a day. So the morning microbiome is not the same as the afternoon or evening microbiome. And this is very important, because we see some companies out there that claim to provide recommendations based on your microbiome, or even worse, they recommend that you buy their supplements based on the microbiome, when the science is just not there to support that. But there's other aspects of gut health that are also important to consider. And that's when we talk about food intolerances. And we talked about lactose intolerance as being one example. Another huge one, of course, is gluten intolerance. And this is a biggie, because when it comes to something like celiac disease, which is the most severe form of gluten intolerance, we know that roughly 85 to 90% of cases are still undiagnosed. So despite the fact that we have all these gluten-free products on the supermarket shelves these days, and that's been tremendous, there's still so many cases that are not diagnosed. And the reason is simply that in celiac disease, it starts off in the gut, but it affects all kinds of systems throughout the body. So people can experience joint pains, skin rashes, anxiety, depression, even seizures, all caused by gluten. And they'll never know because unless they have those classic symptoms of gastrointestinal problems like diarrhea, most physicians are not going to suspect celiac disease. But that is something that is very important to consider. In our test, we look at 6 genetic markers for celiac disease. And it's important that if you do look at a genetic test for gluten intolerance, that it has to have at least 6 genetic markers. If it doesn't, there is a 15% chance, and I say that specifically because some genetic tests only look at 2 markers. So that kind of takes us back to buyer beware and be careful that some genetic tests might give you false information that just does not apply to you. This is something that we're trying to improve the quality of the data that's being provided by all kinds of different genetic tests.
Yeah, there are some pitfalls out there and you really need to know who to trust. And it's important that you're working with qualified healthcare providers. So I do get this question a lot. What are, if there are any, limitations of nutritional genomics testing right now?
First, I would say is cost. I mean, it costs a few $100s and not everyone can afford that. But I often say that even if we gave away genetic testing for free, a lot of people can't afford to eat the foods that are really nutritious. Food insecurity is a big issue and something that is a greater societal issue that we all really need to work on and improving. Having said that, for those who do have access to this kind of information and can afford a genetic test, why not, right? In terms of figuring out what's going to work best for me, how can I improve my health even further and try to avoid some of these chronic diseases? So that's just one limitation. Sometimes people get a bit spooked when it comes to genetics. They think that somehow the company's going to clone them or sell their genetic information. I can only speak on behalf of Nutrigenomics. I can guarantee people we will never clone you. We'll never even try because A, why would we? We don't even know who these people are, right? We just get anonymized samples. And that's another thing in terms of privacy and confidentiality. Some people worry that that information is going to get out there. And again, it differs from company to company. So for us, we don't collect any personal identifying information on the sample. It's just a barcode. Only you, as the dietitian, would know who that sample belongs to. Some might be worried about how that might impact their insurance. In the United States, there is the GINA Act, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, which forbids insurance companies and employers from making any kind of decisions based on your genetics. And in Canada, we have similar legislation as well, and as well as in other countries.
And then looping back to cost, when do you think we'll get some health insurance coverage here?
Whether it's in the United States, Canada, or elsewhere, the payers need to see that there is a return on investment. And there's actually been some research that has shown that lifestyle interventions that include a genetic test actually result in savings of over $1,000 a year in medication for the metabolic syndrome. And so there are some companies that are self-insured that do cover the cost of this kind of test. But for those who have coverage for dietitian service, that can actually help offset the cost of the test.
It's more looking at things long-term and how do we prevent chronic disease from occurring in the future.
Absolutely. There's a huge societal benefit, as you say, from the reduction in healthcare expenditures, but there's also a huge personal benefit for those individuals. And it's a matter of really prioritizing individuals' discretionary funds. But if you choose to make that investment in your own health, that I think is a wise decision for the long run.
So we're wearing devices and tracking and just a lot of intense personalization. And I'm wondering if you ever see that slip into being obsessive about your health or disordered eating. I definitely have a lot of folks that are really riding that line. How do you talk to people about that?
that is a tricky area. I wear my Oura Ring for my sleep, my Apple Watch for sleep and fitness. A while ago, I tried a CGM just out of curiosity, just to see what happens when I eat different kinds of foods. And it's all just extra information that gives you some insights into your own inner workings. Now, the psychology behind how that might cause adverse behaviors like disordered eatings, that's not really my area of expertise, so I can't really comment on that specifically. But for those who perhaps are not prone to such a condition, knowledge is power. And so whether it's an app that tells you about your sleep cycle, or whether it's a genetic test that tells you about your vitamin C metabolism, if those tools can help motivate you to adopt healthier lifestyle behaviors, then I think that's a great thing to do.
I'm so glad you could break all that down for us. It's so important to have this background and understanding about what nutrigenomics is and how it's used. Next time we meet, I really like to dive into a consumer download on nutritional genomics and really what people can expect and what the testing is like and what you're going to see on those reports, as well as how they're going to help change your health in your life. Our show is sponsored by Orgain and produced in collaboration with Large Media. That's L-A-R-J Media. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Good Clean Nutrition Podcast. To stay up to date on the latest podcast episodes, be sure to hit follow on your podcast app. And if you like this podcast, I'd love for you to let us know. You can rate and review this show on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, or you can give us a thumbs up on YouTube if you're watching right now. I'm Ginger Holton. You can find me online at gingerholtonnutrition.com. Thanks so much for listening.